Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, October 17th, 2016. Amy Goodman has surrendered to authorities who have shifted the charges against her for practicing journalism in North Dakota. At Standing Rock, the scene of the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, we've got live commentary from the scene. But before we begin, friends, I have to share some of the pain that I'm feeling right now. I heard from my mother yesterday. She called to say goodbye as she is entering hospice. And just moments ago, before I sat down behind the microphone, a friend called to inform me that my friend of almost 30 years, San Francisco political journalist Richard Rappaport, is clinging to life. He is confronting Lewy body disease, which is now better known because it led to the suicide of Robin Williams. And as if that's not enough, one of my longtime stalwart supporters and subscribers here at the Peter B. Collins podcast, Bob Donjacour, is fighting for his life at a hospital in San Francisco. And it was just a few weeks ago that Bob rode his bicycle from San Francisco to Colorado and then took the train back. And on that bike last Thursday evening, he was run over, or at least he had an incident, with a man in a car who drove away from the scene, leaving Bob severely injured, spinal, hip injuries, and most seriously, brain injury. And I'm on a Caring Bridge link to follow updates in Bob's case. They appear to have found the gentleman who, was responsible for hitting him. But it's a very serious issue for Bob Donjacour. So I'm not a man of prayer, but perhaps you are. Whatever your method is for sharing energy or compassion, I hope you'll direct it toward those individuals at this particular time. So Amy Goodman, who is a stalwart journalist, the anchor for Democracy Now!, was in North Dakota around Labor Day, and she was there when they let the dogs run wild. These were the security dogs from the private security contractor G4S, and she covered that scene. As a result, she was accused first of trespass. But last week, her attorneys were notified by the prosecutors in North Dakota that they thought they couldn't really sustain that charge, so they were shifting it to a charge of riot. Now, this is really insulting to any thinking person and to anyone who values the First Amendment. But the charge of criminal trespass has now been changed to riot. And I placed a call to one of the finest activists that I know, Colonel Ann Wright, who most recently was aboard the Women's Flotilla to Gaza. And she is in North Dakota. And here is the conversation that I had with her as she gathered to go into the courtroom to support Amy Goodman today.
I'm actually at the courthouse near Bismarck, where Amy Goodman is turning herself in right now.
Uh-huh.
For riot.
Well, I'm recording right now. Can you give us a brief description of the scene there and the number of people who are there supporting Amy?
Sure, yeah. Well, this is in Madan, M-A-N-D-A-N, North Dakota, which is right across the river from Bismarck, and apparently is the county seat for the county in which a lot of the water protectors are staging their challenge to the big pipeline that is being dug through their reservation and their sacred lands. And Amy Goodman, over Labor Day, was up here covering the challenges to this pipeline when she filmed some of the oppressive attacks, which was included using attack dogs on children, and seeing a dog with blood in its mouth, and she was yelling at the policeman, "Your dog is attacking children. What is this all about?" Well, she was arrested, apparently charged for rioting, and she's here today to say to the court all of her, her professional journalist background is that she reports on what's going on. She's not a part of what's going on, but reporting on it. And mm-hmm. and she's in, has been charged with, substantial violations of their law.
And right, this is ridiculous on the face of it. They haven't had riots in this part of North Dakota ever. And so to suggest that this legally crossed the line, she was originally charged with trespassing, I believe, and now they've kind of upgraded this to riot. We also have the case of Dia Schlossberg, the documentary filmmaker, who is facing up to 45 years in prison for her work in covering these water protector protests. So it appears that there's a concerted effort to silence the press by making examples of these two journalists.
Yes, and right now we have, you can probably hear in the background, there's a shouts of water is rights, and this is from a group of people who have come to Bismarck, part of the group that's out at Standing Rock, who have come and have blocked one of the bridges between Maidan and Bismarck. And there was I wouldn't say a confrontation, but they walked across the bridge stopping traffic, and then the police gave them an ultimatum to turn around and go back or get arrested. And so they wanted to come over in support of Amy, so they've come over here now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been quite a good morning of a good, solid citizen protest against oppressive government tactics, to include charging people with things to make sure that they don't do them again. And so they're charging journalists, as you mentioned, with these things like rioting and potentially 45 years in prison, which is just outrageous. And even in the local press, there's a note of disbelief in how their own prosecutors are handling these cases.
And Colonel, describe, if you will, the extent to which you've seen the militarization of this standoff with unarmed, peaceful First Amendment activists. Because I've heard reports of the deployment of helicopters and aerial surveillance on a daily basis, these Bearcat armed personnel carriers and MRAPs left over from the war in Iraq. What is your description of the level of militarization?
Well, we just had a school bus load of people who are part of our protest gang. A school bus full of them have just come by.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's a lot of a lot of activism, and and as you can hear, here come the lawyers, I think, for Amy. And we're gonna try to get in the courthouse, so I may have to cut off right now.
All right, Ann, I'll let you do that. Thank you for bearing
okay.
witness, and you're there speaking
Indeed.
For me.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Peter Reed Collins.
Amy Goodman is not the only journalist facing intimidation by the authorities in North Dakota. Dia Schlossberg, who is an Emmy Award-winning documentarian, she works in collaboration with Josh Fox of, what was his movie called? I can't think of it right now. It's about fracking. Gasland, I'm sorry, that's the name of his film. Anyway, she was arrested last week. You recall, I covered the unusual protest where five activists at five different locations shut down tar sands pipelines connecting the output of the oil fields in Canada to refineries in the United States. And I thought that was a very interesting and dramatic direct action. And Schlossberg was there filming one of the groups or individuals who shut down one of those pipelines. She was arrested on Friday, charged with three felonies: conspiracy to theft of property, conspiracy to theft of services, and conspiracy to tampering with or damaging a public service. Now, this is flatly unconstitutional. And I predict that both Schlossberg and Amy Goodman will prevail. And Amy Goodman collected $100,000 from the police in St. Paul, who roughed her up and her crew and arrested them after the Republican convention there back in, 2008? 2008. So these are tactics of desperate law enforcement officials who are, I think, full of arrogance and a determination to try to squelch these Native American-led protests, and I predict they will fail. I'm linking to a piece that Joan Baez submitted and was published in the Sunday San Francisco Chronicle. She was at Standing Rock recently, and she said, "I joined Standing Rock Sioux in protest of the oil pipeline." I recommend that you read her piece, and I'm glad to see that she lent her voice, and I don't mean that as a pun, to this very important effort. Now, we know that surveillance is active around the Standing Rock scene, and we know that police have the tools to access your social media posts, your Twitter feeds in particular, and they use it to alert law enforcement to the intentions of protesters, activists, and the like. Now, we have an ACLU confirmation of a company called Geofedia. And Geofedia has been aggregating social media activity and feeding it to law enforcement agencies. And that is how they get access to a tweet or a Facebook post that says, "Hey, you know, Joan Baez is going to be at Standing Rock, and we're all going to sing Amazing Grace together." Now, that's not a crime. And the surveillance of this non-criminal activity is highly suspect in and of itself. What Fourth Amendment basis of probable cause is available to them to justify the use of these technologies to spy on people? And we know that with what I call the vertical integration of law enforcement since 9/11, the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, the fusion centers run by the Department of Homeland Security, they operate in collaboration with state and local law enforcement agencies, and they use the federal authorities given to them after 9/11 in the Patriot Act and other legislation that was intended to protect us from terrorists. And instead, it is being used to stifle the expression of unarmed, non-militant, non-violent First Amendment activists. We know that in North and South Dakota, where they were anticipating protests in large numbers around the Keystone XL pipeline, they were pre-investigating people, compiling dossiers and photographs to supply to local law enforcement, and the protests never occurred. There were no violent events that would cause law enforcement to conduct that kind of pre-investigation. Now, to its credit, last week after this was exposed, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter announced that they would suspend their cooperation with Geofedia. And how about this Orwellian statement from the CEO of Geofedia? His name is Phil Harris. He said that the company is committed to the principles of personal privacy, transparency, and both the letter and the spirit of the law when it comes to individual rights. He said his platform is a critical tool in helping ensure public safety while protecting civil rights and liberties. And to that I say, crassly, bullshit. Now, I credit the San Francisco Chronicle, which rarely delves into these issues of government surveillance. They put a reporter on it. Her name is Marissa Lang, and she also reference that Geofedia is not the only company that gathers and analyzes social media data. There's another company called SnapTrends. I've never heard of them before, and I hope that they get outed, and I hope likewise that Facebook and Twitter will disconnect from them. And to her credit, Marissa Lang also references the use of Stingray by law enforcement agencies in these kinds of situations. The latest release from WikiLeaks includes actual transcripts of the very special speeches, as Bernie Sanders put it, that Hillary Clinton gave to Goldman Sachs for $225,000 a pop. And I haven't had a chance to go through them line by line, but the news accounts I read suggest that there aren't any real damaging revelations. It is embarrassing to hear her cozy up to the bankers, tell them that the Dodd-Frank was just a political response, and that we need your help, Wall Street, to help us get regulation of Wall Street right. Now, that's not criminal, but it does show her bias toward the people who wrote those big checks. And the thing that will never be available from reading the transcripts, even if you do it with a magnifying glass, is the back-channel relationships that are established between a speaker who gets over $200,000 for a one-hour speech and, say, Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, who wrote the check to her. And that's a gift that keeps on giving. You know that his phone calls will be returned. You know that his candidates for administration jobs will be given deep consideration. And that, to me, is the real stinky part of these relationships that, as I say, don't show up in the text of a speech. Well, I have to say that Michelle Obama's comments last week in New Hampshire have gained a lot of traction. And I give her a lot of credit for heartfelt remarks criticizing Donald Trump. And she's quoted here, "I can't believe that I'm saying that a candidate for president of the United States has bragged about sexually assaulting women. I can't stop thinking about this," she said. "It has shaken me to my core." And she spoke in a way that I think every woman I know, can relate to. It's like that sick, sinking feeling you get when you're walking down the street minding your own business and some guy yells out vulgar words about your body. Or when you see that guy at work that stands just a little too close, stares a little too long, so you feel uncomfortable in your own skin. I can tell you that the men in my life do not talk about women this way. To dismiss this as everyday locker room talk is an insult to decent men everywhere, and locker room chatter, too. And I think that because, as many media observers have pointed out, Hillary Clinton is not really in a position to confront Donald Trump directly about this because of the way he has positioned his behavior as less damaging than Bill Clinton's actions. And that does compromise Hillary Clinton very clearly. And her silence over the years is something that has always troubled me. It's not like she has to talk about it every day, but she has never addressed her own feelings about her husband's infidelity, her own feelings about these other women. And so the silence creates an opening that Trump is a low enough operator to opportunistically take advantage of. The president of CNN, Jeff Zucker, has indirectly acknowledged that the network has made a mistake in giving Trump too much airtime. Now, this has been obvious for over a year. And as I have pointed out, NBC really deserves the blame for originally creating the Trump phenomenon. But then it was not alone once he became a candidate. They all just bent over. Not just backwards, they bent way over. And they would invite him on every TV show they had. They would just, you know, if he's giving a rally somewhere, they'd put their cameras on the podium and make us sit there and watch until he finally showed up. There were times when Bernie Sanders was speaking, and all of the networks would show a Trump podium with no one there and ignore the speech that Sanders was giving. And I've pointed out to many people who understand the law that there is an equal time provision in the Federal Communications Act of 1934, it's just called the Communications Act, I don't want to confuse you, and yet nobody has honored them this year, and this is the monster that Trump has created. Now, I want to acknowledge here, and you know I don't support Donald Trump in the slightest, that the media is clearly biased at this current stage. And I'll just give you one example. It's not even a news program. Saturday Night Live is doing a great job. Alec Baldwin is playing Trump. And I don't even know the name of the actress who does a dead-on characterization of Hillary Clinton. But several weeks in a row now, they open the show with these scenes. They're very funny. But in the most recent show, last Saturday Night Live, the opening segment played. It was good. It was funny. It was relevant. It was current. And then there were two more pieces scattered throughout the show that were attacks on Melania Trump. And one was amusing, the other one just seemed weird to me. But when you just take a look at the, you know, who gets the attention and who gets the critical attention, They took one swipe at both candidates and then came back and took two more swipes only at Trump and his wife. And so I think that that's just one observation, one measure of the extent to which the media has tilted against Trump and toward Clinton. Jim Rutenberg, who is a media writer for the New York Times, tried to unpack the recent and kind of escalating charges that Donald Trump has been issuing about the media, how unfair they are to him. Rutenberg notes that the press who cover Trump is getting more and more hostile treatment from the crowds and that he eggs them on. And those are fair statements. And Rutenberg has this interesting acknowledgement. The idea that the press is part of some grand conspiracy against the people, presented in such incendiary terms, goes well beyond the longstanding Republican complaints of liberal bias. But it is resonating with a large portion of the American electorate. There are many reasons, some of which should cause the news media to make good on its promises to examine its own disconnect from the cross-section of Americans whose support for Mr. Trump it never saw coming. Now, that's a backhanded way of admitting not only that they underestimated him, but in many ways they egged him on at the same time. Then, deep in this article, he tries to go for a little balance, and he shows that the email leaks, the WikiLeaks dumps of the last 10 days or so, do have important information. He cites one where Donna Brazile, who is now the chair of the Democratic National Committee, she was vice chair before, she also had a job at CNN, and she passed along to the Clinton campaign a question from a CNN town hall. CNN denies that they gave her the question, and she denies having access to them, but she managed to pass them along to the campaign. And so I want to reference, and I've linked to Trevor Timm's latest op-ed in the Guardian newspaper, where he points out the duality here, if you will. His headline reads, "If Trump leaks are okay and Clinton leaks aren't, there's a problem." He says that this race has come down to, leak versus leak. He says leaks exposing Trump's behind-the-scenes comments and actions are not only legitimate in the Clinton eyes, but are encouraged. Correct the Record, the super PAC that's openly admitted it thinks it can coordinate with the Clinton campaign, is asking for Trump leaks on its website. And that's David Brock's operation. Then they go on to note that the New York Times reporter David Barstow, one of the people who broke the Trump tax return story, said that he doesn't know who leaked that to the New York Times, and he doesn't know their motivation, but he's got the information, so he's going to run it. But this meme that the Russians are responsible for the hacks that WikiLeaks is publishing, and there is no proof for this still, are having an impact. And there are many media outlets who are just steering clear of it or providing really sketchy, you know, surface coverage, acknowledging that the leaks are there, but not reporting the contents. And this is a very clear bias. Now, Donald Trump exaggerates all this. He turns it into, you know, creating himself as a victim. And I don't buy into any of that. But as an observer here who supports neither Clinton or Trump, I can say that I see the bias and the favoritism that is being played out here. Now, Donald Trump, who sniffed his way through the first two debates and presented as a coke user, I have no proof, but people who've used a lot of cocaine looked at that and said, oh yeah, he's got the blow nose. Well, last week he suggested that Hillary Clinton submit to a drug test before the next debate, suggesting that she had high energy at the beginning and kind of flagged at the end. But I think he was actually talking about his own performance. And this is just another element of the weird that is so classic in representing the Trump campaign. Now, Trump is also escalating his claims that the election is rigged, but he bases that on claims of voter fraud, not election fraud. And as you know, I don't believe there is any significant voter fraud. Maybe here and there, you know, somebody gets to cast an extra ballot illegally. But Rudy Giuliani was all over television on Sunday saying that, and he points the finger at Philadelphia, where Trump has been focusing his laments, saying, you know, people vote 2, 4, 6, 8 times. A lot of dead people vote, he said. There's no evidence to support that. What there is evidence to support is in Greg Palast's new film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And Greg was in San Francisco screening that over the weekend. I caught up with him at the Saturday night show and helped him with the Q&A afterward. And the second time seeing the movie really made a deep impression on me. He very clearly lays out that the Republican-initiated interstate cross-check list is scrubbing the voter rolls of people in states all over the country who have no knowledge. And when they show up on election day expecting to be able to vote, their name's not going to be on the list. And the reason is that somebody with the same first and last name, but not the same social security number, driver's license, date of birth, or other identifying info, is showing up on a list, and they're using these crude cross-check lists to eliminate voters. And what Palast shows in the film is that this is ultimately funded by the Koch brothers and by the vulture, Paul Singer. He's a vulture capital investor who, and the conclusion that Greg Palast reaches is that they're doing all this trying to control the election and the government to keep their tax rates low. The carried interest rate is what this is ultimately about. And I want to note that the polls are very fluid right now. For example, Trump has tied Clinton in Ohio, where a week ago he was trailing by 5 or 6 points. And I want to note that right up to Election Day, I am not spending a lot of time studying the polls or sharing that information with you because I don't know that it's going to be accurate. The reason is there are many silent Trumpers out there who aren't going to tell a pollster how they will vote. And there are also many efforts at manipulation and voter suppression that are not accurately represented by public opinion polls. So I think it's going to be a wild ride. And what do we have? 3 more weeks to go. And so far, the Clinton campaign has doubled the money as the Trump campaign. Now, Donald could change that if he has money and wrote himself a big check. He's been putting in about $2 million a month for the last 6 months, but his claim that he'll spend $100 million of his own money is short by $56 million so far. And the Clinton campaign has $150 million in the bank. I have taken it upon myself to be the alerter for you of what I call lame duck mission creep. And as President Obama heads into his final days, we are seeing renewed military action and some covert operations that are surfacing. And I want to briefly touch on these. In Yemen, last week, the United States responded to attempted missile strikes on ships offshore in Yemen by firing back and destroying rebel radar facilities with missiles, even though the military admits they don't actually know who tried to fire missiles at them to begin with. And as the New York Times reports, this underscores the concerns that many people in Yemen have, that it's the United States that has been waging this extended campaign, the hidden hand behind the Saudi Arabia-initiated military action. And I think that this is accurate. We have now an apology from the Saudis for the what they claim was a targeting error that led to the death of 100 people in Yemen at a funeral about a week ago. And they're saying, without telling us where the targeting information came from, the site was wrongly targeted, which resulted in the wounding and loss of civilian souls, according to the statement. Well, last time I heard, and the New York Times doesn't even speculate about this in its coverage, the United States has been providing the intelligence for the Saudi operations in Yemen. Are we apologizing? Are we accepting responsibility? No. We are firing missiles from ships onshore into Yemen. Meanwhile, the Times on Sunday covered for the first time covert operations that have been underway for over a year in Somalia. The Obama administration has intensified a clandestine war. Hundreds of American troops now rotate through makeshift bases in Somalia. About 200 to 300 American special ops troops are there, plus SEAL Team 6. Did you know that? What are we fighting for in Somalia? Does anybody have a clue? Has the president told the American people that this is, you know, a direct interest of the United States that requires us to take action? Nope. Nobody asks, nobody tells. This is the new don't ask, don't tell. And finally, on my lame duck mission creep list, the U.S. is said to be supporting the efforts of 30,000 Iraqi and Kurdish troops to retake Mosul, one of the best advertised military initiatives in recent history. Today, Kurdish forces began advancing on villages east of Mosul, and the question that is not asked or answered in the coverage that I have reviewed about this so far is, are there still substantial elements of the Islamic State in Mosul? We've heard that they were slipping away, and since we telegraphed our intentions for quite a while, it would be reasonable to assume that that is the case. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Carl Howard in Columbus, Ohio, Tim McKay, let's see who else on the list here, Janet Price, and Grant Gibson in Portland, Oregon. I'm grateful for your support, and I hope that you will be so enthusiastic that you'll want to become a subscriber too. Why not? Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page, and in just a couple of minutes, you can be set up with your very own subscription to the Peter B. Collins Podcast. And finally today, I'm pleased to report that the author of The Guantanamo Diary, a bestseller, Mahamudu Ould-Slahi, has finally been freed from Gitmo after 14 years in American custody. He will be returned to his native Mauritania. He was never charged with any offense. He was cleared for release back in 2010. Once again, he was cleared in July at a parole board hearing. And I am relieved to see that he has been released. But there are still about 60 men left there, and it's pretty clear that Obama will not be able to keep his pledge to close Guantanamo before he leaves office. Thanks for joining me today for news and comment. I appreciate your listening and your support. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.